Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, First Draft. ESPN experts Mel Kiper Jr., Todd McShay, and Field Yates keep tabs on the NFL draft throughout the year, but their moment of truth is finally here. Check it out for final previews and immediate reaction to all seven rounds as the picks get made. Follow First Draft as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Also, baseball is back and so are your favorite teams and players. Catch the best of the bigs all season on ESPN Plus with over 170 live MLB games featuring every star and every team in the league. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com/baseball. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we'll talk about something weird going on with the Olympics. Also, we'll pick back up at The Right Time Book Club with Alonzo Highsmith, former running back for the Miami Hurricanes. But first... All right, so I got a question for people. I'm just kind of curious about this. Are you guys enjoying this NBA season? And I'm asking this because it appears that the ratings are not good for this season. You know, last year it was like, okay, it was a quarantine. People's habits were a bit thrown off, so forth and so on. Well, we're in a little bit of a different place right now. It doesn't quite feel that way anymore. I don't know if I want to say things feel a bit more normal, but they do. But even if... Like, it's basketball season now. There hasn't been a 3-month gap in between that we're asking people to get back up on. Like, it's here. This is a time when people would generally be watching basketball. The schedule's a little bit thrown off slightly, but 72-game season, I think we got for most teams about 10, 15 games left. Like, this is when it should feel like we're getting up for the playoffs and everything, but something doesn't quite seem to feel the same, or at the very least, it doesn't seem to me that for most people, that things kind of sort of feel the same, and I don't really have a great answer for why it is that that's the case. Now, Gabe, maybe part of that is injuries, right? Like, you are a Lakers fan, and you haven't seen the Lakers team that you thought you were going to see all year long, right? Like, have you been as into it this year as you have been in previous years?
I haven't. I think injuries are part of it, but I also think that the fact that for a portion of the year the fans were in the stands, then you get fans back in the stands, it doesn't necessarily feel like a regular NBA season. And since the last NBA season was shortened, it almost feels like this one is almost like, can we just speed this thing up and get this to the playoffs in a more so way than it has in years past, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, like, once we get to the playoffs, like, is that going to be the thing that brings people around? Because it used to be, you know, a sort of thing. People like, I only watch the NBA during the playoffs. Like, people love to brag about that for some reason. Are they actually going to do that? I have found and felt over the years that there's a segment of people that loves to talk about how much they don't watch the NBA. Right? Like, that's just something they get out of talking to their friends. Me and Shannon used to have this in Raleigh where people would swear, but we don't watch the NBA because we talk about the NBA. And this one, we don't watch the NBA. And then we got back television numbers for all the markets. And the Raleigh-Durham market did big on the NBA. We're like, oh, so you guys have been watching. And the phone lines would blow up with people explaining, well, I'm only watching because... Well, you know, there's nothing else on TV, like you're obligated somehow to watch television. I don't know if they was doing it for their partners or whatever it was, but they always had to have some cockamamie explanation as to why it was that they were actually watching the NBA, right? Like you can't just be like, I really like basketball. Like, this is supposed to be basketball country, right? But they afraid their white friends was going to look at them funny because they were watching the NBA. But it really does look like fewer of those people are watching the NBA. And I have a bit of a theory. It's LeBron's fault. And this is what I mean when I say it's LeBron's fault. It's not really LeBron's fault. However, for the last 10 years, LeBron James has been the dominant figure in NBA storyline generation, right? Now, this is after he's become an MVP and all this stuff. Like, we've had this before. But when he made the trip to Miami, when he decided that that's where he was going to go, everything was just kind of centered around that team, because that team was really this revolutionary idea that Bosh and LeBron would come play with Wade. They build the rest of the team from the ground up. But the idea of those guys being on a team together was a legitimately provocative notion. And so what you wound up with was people on two sides. The people, one, who felt like basically LeBron had ruined basketball and had kind of cheated the system or whatever it was. And then you had those people who rooted against them. But on the other side, you had people like me who thought the whole idea was really cool. And so you basically wound up on either side of it. Like when that finals came around in 2011, outside of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, how many people were actually rooting for the Mavericks rather than rooting against the Heat? Like, it seemed like the basketball watching public was split between people rooting for the Heat, which was really rooting for LeBron, and people rooting against the Heat, which was really rooting against LeBron. And ever since then, really in some form or fashion, LeBron has really been the dominant storyline, except I would argue the 2015-2016 season, the year the Warriors won 73 games. It was all about them. Like, we kind of got hip to the Warriors the year that they won their first championship. You know, they won 67 games. They were rolling. But there was also all the drama. That was the year that LeBron just took 2 weeks off in the middle of the year and just went to Miami to work out with Dwayne Wade, which remains one of the strangest things that has ever happened in the course of an NBA season that we just don't talk about. Like, we get all Kyrie about this, I need a little personal time, whatever. LeBron just said, I'm taking 2 weeks off to go get my body right, and came back looking like a brand new man. And I can't think of any situation that's ever been similar to what that was. But like, there was a bit of drama that surrounded that team that I think kept people interested. Then after that, we wind up in the Kevin Durant place. And so maybe that was less about LeBron than it was what was going on with the Warriors, except Durant going to the Warriors, I don't feel like made people more interested in the NBA as much as people looked at that and then said, well, damn, nobody has a chance now. And then kind of, you know, backed away from there. Then LeBron goes to the Lakers, and that was the interesting thing. And then he got hurt, and then they didn't make the playoffs or whatever it was. But since then, there's been nothing really, like, truly captivating about the NBA, like a top-line thing. Like, this is what we're going to pay attention to. Like, for somebody who does television on this stuff, when LeBron was in Miami, whatever the Heat did, that was at the top of the list of whatever show that we were going to do. Heat on a 3-game winning streak, we're going to talk about that. Heat lose 2 games in a row, we're going to talk about that. Heat lose the insert person here, we're going to talk about that. Like, everything was centered around that Heat team. And we kind of carried over with LeBron in some ways. Like, even with Cleveland, that year they had to turn the whole team over. And then we're like, oh, well, is LeBron's team going to be able to figure this thing out? So forth and so on. He has been such a centerpiece. But let me ask this question. Is he interesting anymore? Like, interesting enough to carry the whole NBA? I'm not talking about whether or not he's good. Like, he's obviously still a great basketball player. But is he actually interesting? Like, there are real conversations to be had right now about whether or not LeBron is actually the best player in the NBA. This is the default thing that we say. Advanced numbers do not indicate that he is still the best player in the NBA. But he's LeBron, and at one time we said he wasn't the best player in the NBA. They beat the 73-9 Warriors, and so we ain't never going to say nothing like that ever again. But go look around the league, man, especially considering how many guys are legit two-way players, which LeBron really isn't at this point in his career. If you're not a Lakers fan, what's interesting about LeBron? There's no real chasing Jordan thing going on anymore. Do we think he's going to get to 6 championships? I guess at this point, now that he has 4, it's kind of sort of possible. But I don't think that we're in a place now where people are legitimately, truly considering this idea that he's the greatest player of all time. If you do, you already think it. Okay. If you don't, you already think it. I don't think anything's going to come around to make anybody change their minds about this as he is finishing his 18th year in the league. And even if he was that interesting, he's not playing right now. But if he comes back, like, is LeBron really a draw for you? No, I don't think so. But what's wild to me about it is there's going to be a life, there's going to be a world post LeBron. And the beginning of that is right now. Like, go look around the league. Go look at all these deep. First of all, LeBron hasn't won the MVP in 8 years. So we've had a whole new class of stars that has emerged since the last time he won the MVP. We have got a lot of really interesting teams that are starting to come up to the top in ways that we haven't seen before. Utah, welcome to the party. Phoenix, welcome to the party. And Phoenix got guys that you enjoy watching. They got Chris Paul all this stuff. Now, is it best that maybe the two best teams in the regular season this year play in the Mountain Time Zone, which is the easiest to forget? Maybe not. Top MVP candidate, he is in the Mountain Time Zone. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's part of why we're not really into this. But something I've said about the 1980s, where people talk about that as a golden period in NBA history, a big part of why that seems like such a golden period in NBA history, you had good teams, or at least interesting teams, by the time you get to the late 80s and early 90s, you know, it's some wraparound in there. You got a good team in New York. You had good teams in Philly. You had good teams in Boston. You had good teams in Los Angeles. You had good teams in Chicago. The big markets that really drove America, even Detroit, which had a different national resonance back in the day than it does right now. Good teams were in big markets. We still have that. Not even still, like, we got it back. The Knicks are actually good. We got two teams in New York that are good. We got two teams in Los Angeles that are good. We got a good team in Philadelphia. The Celtics may not be as good as people thought they would be, but they are a good team, and they're still, if nothing else, legitimately interesting. We got that. The Bay Area, top five market in terms of size in this country. They're not as good as they've been before, but they're still pretty damn interesting, and Steph is out here killing it, right? Dallas, really big place, got a star player that people care about there. Miami, a market that at the very least draws interest from people outside of it. We got something going there. Atlanta, they're getting it back going there. This play-in tournament has made the Wizards surprisingly interesting, at least in a way that would make it interesting to the people who are local there. And people still don't seem to care. And you can blame it on social media. You can blame it on hyping up all the stuff that's around the games more than the games themselves. I don't know. I just think that it's fair to ask whether or not LeBron has created such a vacuum that we don't even fully know and understand how to appreciate the NBA if it's not centered around LeBron. Because look, we changed the game up. The style of basketball that's being played is the style of basketball that apparently all y'all have always wanted, right? You got all the ball movement that you wanted. You got all these threes that you wanted. You got all these points that you wanted. All the things that we swore were the things that fans wanted. And I think overwhelmingly, yeah, people do want these things in a lot of ways, right? I'm not a person that pines for the basketball of the 1990s. Not totally. There's some things that we lost in the course of moving to this ball movement, you know, three-point spread out sort of game. But I'm not one that wants to go back to kind of the clogged up sludge that we had in a lot of ways in that basketball. I'm not the person that's asking for that. I'm not the person who needs that. But it all seems to be here. And people just don't seem to care as much. And I don't have a great answer why.
Do you know how much the game is being watched outside of the U.S.?
That I do not know.
Because we're talking about how less people in the United States are watching. What's interesting when you're talking about it through that kind of lens and how, you know, the game is what people wanted it to be, with more ball movement, more shooting threes and stuff like that, is becoming a more international game. So you wonder if there's some sort of flip there where the game is becoming more of a global game than it was before, and hence you've got people around the globe watching it more, which kind of fits in with what the NBA wants, which is trying to expand the footprint there and expand the pie. But then you end up with a situation where domestically the league doesn't perform as well as it once did.
Yeah, because I don't give a damn how much they like it anywhere else. I don't live there. You know what I mean? I do think there's something to that. Like, maybe it's on and popping in China, but who's to say they're a little bit salty with us because your boy Daryl Morey got them Twitter fingers out there. They're the old fake hero. I'll never stop being mad at that. We're going to act like this dude really stood for something and he couldn't even lead a tweet up. He's like, I refuse to apologize. You already did apologize, Daryl. You deleted it. Whew, that guy. That guy. Anyway, I don't know. Like I say, I question and wonder whether or not we have been so LeBron-centric for so long that it's made it difficult for us to go find other things and to appreciate some of these other things that are out there. Like, the Sixers thing is finally kind of turning into what people thought it would be. Joel Embiid has been one of the two best players in the NBA. I think he and Jokic have been the two best players in the NBA this year. But Ben Simmons has been out for how long? Like, that is the other part, I think, is how many times have you turned on an NBA game this year and all the people you would hope to see were actually on the floor? The Nets made that trade to get James Harden. They have played seven games with Kyrie, James Harden, and Kevin Durant. Like, the Nets, and by the way, they are quietly playing over their heads. Like, I don't think they've gotten enough credit for the fact that given how little time they've had all those dudes and how many games they played with one of them out there, right? They're still crushing it. they're still killing it. Like, there's a great level of intrigue as to what's going to happen when they have all three, because they're going to have to figure out exactly how to play together, but we haven't really seen it. The Knicks are good. Now, that's one for me, Gabe, where you start talking about not having fans in the arenas. That one, if they actually had people in Madison Square Garden, it would feel like something else when you watch the Knicks. It doesn't really feel like anything right now because you don't have the energy from the people being there. I do agree that not having people in the crowd has definitely made for a lesser television product. You realize how cracking the Garden would be where they won 9 games in a row so far? And look, we got a chance that at some point we could wind up with Knicks Nets as a playoff series. That would usually shut this city down. Like right now, the Knicks are tied for fourth with the Hawks in the East, which could easily set up Nets-Knicks in the semifinal round. That would be something here. Will it be? Like by the time it actually comes around, will it be? I don't have the answer for that. I don't know. Would there be more interest in the league if, say, Giannis was a potential free agent? Because remember, he took all the intrigue out of that one. I don't know. But I feel like the NBA itself, the play itself, has been good. There have been a lot of good players that we could wrap our arms around. Like, we could wrap our arms around Jokic, but for whatever reason, all my colleagues just want to talk themselves out of Jokic being the MVP. Which, again, strangest thing in the world. Thought y'all like white dudes that look like they don't work out. That used to be y'all shit. Like, that used to be what y'all was all about, fundamentals. You know what I'm saying? Like, it used to be there. For whatever reason, y'all can't get on board with it in the way that you used to. I don't really understand. But it's a problem for the NBA. I think there's no way around that part. It is a problem for the NBA that if you've got this and you don't have the interest, I don't know what's going to bring the interest around. And what it makes me think of is this. I grew up as a giant baseball fan. Huge baseball fan. That was like my number one thing for who knows how long. Like, it kept going and going. I don't really, like, get into baseball like that anymore. It's not because baseball did anything wrong. It's not because I was offended by the steroids or anything else. But for whatever reason, my attachment to baseball just kind of fell off a bit. And is that happening to a lot of people at the NBA? Like, I had more people just be like, yo, I just can't get into it this year. Like, even talk to my dad, right? And he ain't nobody that's going to be offended by Black Lives Matter or nothing like that. He's like, yeah, man, I just can't get on board with it like I had in the past. And for whatever reason, that is how people feel about this league. I don't know how you fix that. I don't know how you correct that. But it's a thing. And for me, it's kind of sad to watch. Because again, I'm looking at this and I'm like, yo, there's so much good stuff that's going on. And fewer people seem to care than I can remember. Damn. So, Gabe, I don't know if you know this, but there's going to be an Olympics this year.
Yeah, it's news to me. News to me as of the last couple of weeks. I was like, wow, they're actually going to try and get this one in.
Our good friends in Japan are pretty damn insistent on making this happen. And one thing to be fair is other places in the world have handled this whole thing better than we have. Right. And so I can understand how I ain't seen Japan's numbers. Right. But maybe they feel like, you know, because of the way they've had things under control, if they can limit who some of the visitors are and stuff that come in. I personally wouldn't let no Americans anywhere near it. We have not demonstrated ourselves to be trustworthy people. But, you know, it's a whole bunch of us and there's a lot of money involved in the U.S. So, damn it, they're going to come over there and we're going to have these Olympics. And we got some news last week that the International Olympic Committee has decided that they will not allow any like forms of protest on the medal stand and stuff like that. Have you seen that? They say that you will be sanctioned if you kneel on the medal stand. I think they got a problem with the phrase Black Lives Matter. What was your thought when you saw that?
My first thought was, has something like this happened before to the point where they've put out measures saying that you cannot protest or anything like that?
Well, they have done things reactively on this matter, right? I mean, obviously 1968. It becomes the most clearest example with Tommy Smith and John Carlos, right? It becomes that. Now, my man Kevin Blackstone wrote a column yesterday that made a point that I was thinking, which is, yo, you guys are setting yourself up for disaster. You have decided that you are going to create martyrs. Like, this is what you've done. Because, look, the truth is, depending on what event you compete in, what sanction can you hit me with after I've already won the gold medal? Like, I might actually want to physically possess the gold medal. I would probably love to have the gold medal. But it seems to me the big deal is I won a gold medal. And if you've already won that gold medal, you can't really take it away. You can't. And so if you're dealing with somebody that's got, so like Simone Biles, for example. Simone Biles got a lot of like long run money caught up in this. Now, granted, this is her second time at the Olympics, so who knows how she'd want to play it. But like if this is her first time at the Olympics, nah, Simone Biles is probably not going to do something like that because, like I say, her money's tied up in a different way. She would want to do that. But somebody that maybe you ain't really heard of like that, this is a great way to become famous. This is a great way to do speaking gigs for the rest of your life. Like, especially when you're at a point where you don't want to go back to the Olympics again, you can do it. You can pull it off and you can become a hero. And the Olympics, the IOC, has basically decided that you, in fact, will be a hero if you do this because you have created a machine to rage against. It's right there. Now, the truth is, if the Olympics hadn't said a word and there were occasionally some people who kneeled, or occasionally says something about the state of the world, wouldn't nobody really pay attention, I don't think. If it was like, you know, I don't know who the new Usain Bolt is because he ain't doing this no more. But like if Usain Bolt had come out there and done something, yeah, that's going to wind up being a big deal. But if the winner of the 400 meter hurdles had decided to kneel, that would be a blip. They're like, oh, somebody decided to kneel on the medal stand. Ain't that something? And then it would pass. It's not going to be what the game is now. And it's wild to me that the Olympics would jump 50 years into the time machine and on the front end decide we're going to be Avery Brundage. Avery Brundage is the man that ran the U.S. Olympics, and I think he later became the head of the IOC. Avery Brundage is the man who had the audacity to ask Jesse Owens to not run in the relay in 1936 so as not to embarrass Hitler at his Olympics, and the man who made the decision to take the medals away from Tommy Smith and John Carlos for raising their fists on the medal stand. Now, the thing about them raising their fists on the medal stand, you had never taken away their medals, you wouldn't have turned them into heroes. Like, they ruined those men, but they turned them into heroes. It wouldn't have been that way if you hadn't done that. And so that's the point that Blackstone makes that I think is absolutely correct here. Now you're daring people to do something. Now you're asking people to protest. Because you're going to scare some people, right? Some people are going to be shook, and I'm not judging them, by the way, if they are. You're going to get some people shook. You're going to get some people nervous about doing this, but you're going to embolden some people also. You're going to make some people now really want to come out here and do this. And why? Like, what point did you ultimately think that you were going to make? And they say they want to keep this as apolitical as they possibly can make it. Show me where these apolitical Olympics have ever taken place. It's not how it works. Beijing 08, those were very political Olympics because that was China showing itself off to the world. Right. Like that was their, hey, look at us sort of thing. It was absolutely political. Just the mere fact that you had it there, just like having that World Cup in Qatar is absolutely political just by the mere fact that you were doing it. Having the World Cup in Russia when they had it was absolutely political just by the mere fact that you were doing it. And so, hey, good luck to you guys. Right? Maybe you think this is what's going to make sure that you have the most peaceful Olympics ever. But the truth is, aside from like Black Lives Matter and stuff like that, there's a lot of people in the world going through a lot of things and a lot of good causes that could be publicized to the world where people need to know this. Right? So this is a paragraph from Blackstone's column. He says, when protest is prohibited, it stands out. It resonates. It captures and demands our attention, our curiosity, and makes us investigate. When Ethiopian marathoner Faisa Lelisa crossed the finish line at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Games while crossing his arms, many of us wondered why. We learned it was the gesture made by people from Oromia, the region home to Lelisa and Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, to protest a brutal government crackdown. I appreciated knowing that when it happened. Like, I remember that now. I hadn't thought about it, but I appreciated knowing that. This is a chance to do good for the world. And the Olympics, just trying to do good for the money. And I'm just saying, you might be sizing yourselves up, given everything else that's going on, for this to wind up being like a wild, disastrous Olympics for a number of reasons, in large part because nothing looks good about cracking down on the whole reason any of us watch this, and it's because of the athletes, not because of nobody in charge. The Right Time with Bomani Jones Book Club is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Counseling. Visit BetterHelp.com/Bomani for 10% off your first month of online therapy. All right, it is the Right Time Book Club. This year we are reading Kane Mutiny, How Miami Overturned the College Football Establishment by Bruce Feldman. Spencer Hall joined us for our first installment. We got Joel Anderson joining us for our next installment, and then Bruce Feldman, the author, will join us for the final installment. But now joining us from the vaunted Miami class of 1983 incoming, now works with the Seattle Seahawks. His name is Alonzo Highsmith. Thank you so much for coming on. Now, my question for you is, what was your in-home visit like with Howard Schnellenberger?
Well, you know, it was a funny time because I had just moved from Montreal, Canada. People didn't realize I was from Montreal, Canada. My dad played in Canadian Football League. My family decided that it was best for me to move to Florida and have myself an opportunity to play against some of the best kids in the nation in Miami, Florida. So I ended up finding a high school and I went there for my junior and senior year in high school, and rest is history, and became a pretty good football player in high school football, and never really heard of the University of Miami until I arrived in Miami. And because my dad was from Florida, he played football at Florida A&M. So I knew the history of Florida A&M University. And my dad played for the Rattlers during the 60s with Bob Hayes and all those guys. And so I really never heard of University of Miami. And then my junior year in high school, my high school coach took me to see the University of Florida versus the Miami Hurricanes in the Orange Bowl. And there were 72,000 people. And I saw a team come out running through the smoke. It was the University of Miami. And from that point forward, I wanted to be a Hurricane. So it wasn't really a hard sell for the University of Miami, but I didn't let them know that. You were getting recruited by everyone in the nation. After meeting Howard Schnellenberger and him coming into my home, telling me what his vision was, and that if he could find a way to keep all the kids from South Florida and put a fence around the state of Florida, the state of Miami, he called it, he said, we'll dominate and win national championships. And he sold me right there.
You know, I did not realize that either about you being from Canada, which means I imagine for you, them Miami boys are different, man. Like, I can't imagine what it's like coming from Montreal and now you coming down and you dealing with these dudes.
You know, the funniest thing was that I went to an all-boys Catholic high school called Christopher Columbus High School. Bob Greasy's kids went there and I played with the Bonaconis. It was a very prominent high school. I really didn't know much about the high school because you signed up with a fax machine or something like that. And you go there and there were only 3 to 4 African-Americans in the school. And then you play, our district was Jackson High School, Northwestern High School, Miami Edison High School, serious football. But we were a good football program and we were able to go to the state championship my senior year. So it was a great experience for me. But I figured out at that time that Dade County football was some of the best football in America. Still is.
So you were playing against Melvin Bratton in high school.
I was trying to tear his butt up. I was outside linebacker. I never played running back in high school. We ran 40s. I was 235 pounds. I was fast, athletic. Coach Schnellenberger came to me one day and he said, have you ever played running back? I said, nope, I'm an All-American linebacker. I want to be Lawrence Taylor. That's who I wanted to be. That's who I emulated all through high school. And then Schnellenberger came to me. The thing that made me do it was one reason. If he had told me Alonzo moving into running back and you could win the Heisman Trophy and all that stuff and be All-American, I wouldn't have done it. He told me that if I moved to fullback, I'd make us national contenders for national championships. And my dad was a high school coach, and I've always said in football, in order to be a good football team or a good organization, you always have to be willing to give more of yourself. So I figured I was giving more of myself to the program and to this team to make us better by moving to fullback. Not that I couldn't play linebacker. I probably would have been an All-American linebacker. But coach said, would you do this for the team? And that's why I did it.
Now, your class, 83, with you and Bratton and a lot of those guys, is the class that's really considered like the beginning of the you, right? Like, this is when the personality started to come in. But one thing is interesting, I asked Howard this, I guess this is about 7-8 years ago, where if he had stayed past 1983, would we have seen a lot of what we saw from the program later? And he told me, no, everybody would be wearing suits and so forth and so on. So what was the difference when Jimmy Johnson got there?
I think that things might have been a little bit different, but you got to remember something. Miami had a lot of swag and was a lot of finger point, a lot of talking, but that started with the class before I got to Miami. Tony Fitzpatrick, these guys were some cocky dudes, man, and they might not have been as brash, but of all the Miami teams, that 1983 team that won a national championship, that team would fight you in a bar. You would not want to mess with those guys. They were beer drinkers. They were tough. I'll put it this way. If you got into a fight with that crew in 1982, all those seniors and juniors, you would have your hand full. And that's what they taught us. We bought a certain gamesmanship, which added to the brash, tough guy role that the previous class had coming in 1983. And it all caught lightning in a bottle all at the exact same time. And then you add Jimmy Johnson, and Jimmy Johnson was brash. He was bold. He wanted you to play with excitement. He wanted you to high five. He wanted you to look like you were having fun. The thing that was interesting was the fact that when we would play teams, teams would say, man, I wish our coaches would let us have fun like you guys. You guys look like you're having fun out there. And we realized that when we started talking to other teams and seeing other teams that, you know, we were having fun. Football was fun, and we made it fun by winning. And Coach Johnson always said, I don't care what you guys do, but enjoy yourselves, work hard, work hard, and work hard. And you won't enjoy yourself if you're not winning. So all that together was kind of like a lightning in a bottle, all caught at the exact same time, you know, and it went on to some great things. I met a kid who told me that he didn't see a loss in the Orange Bowl for 10 years. That's a long run. Think about that. You only played 6 home games a year. We played 11 games back then. And this kid told me from 1985 or 84 until whenever they lost, he didn't see a home loss. He was unaccustomed to it. So I was like, wow.
Yeah, I would say the most interesting thing about it to me was that Jimmy loved it. Like that, when you go look at it, especially considering a man, where he's from, what the era was and everything else, like he just has struck me as so much of an anomaly in so many different ways because he was demanding, right? Like it wasn't like he was letting y'all come up short, but he loved every bit of the stuff that all these other people seem to hate.
I tell you what, Jimmy was good for the program after Howard Schnellenberger. Jimmy brought the 4-3 defense, and Jimmy wanted speed, athleticism, and grit. I tell you what, Howard Schnellenberger, if you ever watched the movie Junction Boys, I understood where he came from. Because I'm going to tell you something. Between Howard and Jimmy, you didn't want to lose because those practices, those that following Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, going to the next game, hey, you're better off winning than just working your ass off and then losing. Because we worked so hard. We used to always joke around sometimes, say, well, if we lose, maybe they'll play us in a doubleheader because I don't want to be around for practice this week. I mean, it was tough. It was competitive. Every single day was competitive. And that was our motto. Everything we did was to win the day. We won the day in practice. We pushed ourselves. We knew what the standards were. We knew what the standards were for practice. Our best players were also our best practice players. And that was the infectious disease that was at Miami. It was all about competition. Get after people. We're going to get after your butt. Hey, you may beat us, but you're going to have a damn sure have to give a lot of effort to beat us because we're talented. We know we're talented and we work harder than you. And that was the motto. It's funny when I've been around some great teams, Super Bowl teams, when those guys get back together, they don't really talk about who scored touchdowns. It's always the same conversations. Man, remember how tough it was. Remember practices. Remember us practicing for 4 hours. Remember the late nights when Coach Schnellenberger said, start practice over, when Jimmy said, start practice over. Those are the building foundations of becoming a man. And I was so fortunate to go through that era where you had to prove yourself. You know what? You're supposed to be a big time player. If it wasn't, I'm not playing. Let me call my parents. Let's transfer schools. Let's get in the portal because I don't want to compete. You know what I mean? This was, they called you out in front of your teammates. If you were soft, they let you know you were soft. If you weren't a good practice player, Jimmy let you know you weren't a good practice player. Nothing but high accountability. And that was what the program was built on.
Well, I've been curious, and I don't see a lot of people talk about this part. What was it like for that stretch in 84, where you've got the loss to Maryland that's the greatest comeback of all time, and then the Hail Mary with Doug Flutie? Because that 84 year was tricky for all you guys.
Yeah, I tell you what, it was a tricky year because we started, went to Michigan, and people don't realize Eddie Brown had a fractured thumb. He couldn't play. And then our best tight end, Willie Smith, had a bad ankle sprain. He couldn't play. Bernie threw 6 interceptions that day. And of those 6 interceptions, none of them were his fault. I don't think they went off the hands of the new receivers in the game, a couple of mistakes and those sorts of things. And then We lost that game. We gained a little momentum and everything was going back again. I'll never forget this. We were up 31-0 versus Maryland. I got hurt the first play from scrimmage in the second half and I was done for the season. I hurt my knee. We lost 3 games in a row after that. We lost the Maryland game. We lost the Doug Flutie game. And then we lost the Fiesta Bowl. So I used to always tell Melvin, my roommate at that time, you know, if I had played, we'd have won all 3 of those games. So you're all right, Melvin. You know, it was a weird year, man. Jimmy Johnson was bringing in the new defense. We had half the old staff that was from Schnellenberger. We had some of Jimmy's staff. The old staff wanted to run 52 defense. Jimmy wanted the 4-3 defense. It was a strange year. You're right. It was real hard. That year was hard because there was so many fractions and so many different things going on that season.
Now, I tell you that in my house, all of us love Miami, except for one person, and that was my mother because she was an OU grad. Oklahoma from 85 to 87 went 33-3, and all the 3 were to Miami. And I'm just like, that scene of you guys at midfield, I think it's in 85, just in Jerome Brown, in those dudes' faces. Like, what was that like?
You know what it was? The thing that's interesting about Miami, we always felt as though we were the little guy. The Notre Dames were the respected. The Oklahoma schools were the big-time respected schools, the USCs. We came along, and yes, we were beating people, but I don't think we weren't respected by everybody. You know what I mean? We were playing Oklahoma. Oklahoma's got all the pageantry of college football, and we don't think we were ever part of the pageantry of college football. You know what I mean? The pageantry of the granddaddy of them all, the Rose Bowls, the Ohio States, the USCs, the folklores of football, the Alabamas, the Notre Dames. Like, we were like the new kids on the block, you know what I mean? And we were trying to get our face in the camera. We were trying to let the nation know who we were. We wanted you to know that we were good. And we weren't taking any from anybody. And we loved playing on the road because playing on the road, you know, it enabled us to go into your house, kick your behind in front of your crowd and point fingers at you. So when Oklahoma came to town, 1 versus 2, we're like, we're not having it today. This is our field. And we're going to let you know from the start, this is our field. It's our game. Don't come in here even thinking. And we're not shaking your hands at the coin toss. We want none of that. That was our aura. That was our attitude, and that permeated down to everybody on the team. White, black, it didn't matter. It was us against the world mentality, and we didn't care what you thought about us. And that's what our program was built on. Our program was built on, yes, there's a lot of talent, but work ethic was what the program was built on.
You know, and the white, black part is interesting to me because every time people talk about the Fiesta Bowl of 86, there's literally nothing new to say about that. But the thing I always find most interesting that nobody talks about is when that clip comes out of y'all getting off the plane, the second or third dude off the plane is Vinny Testaverde, and he looks like he's loving every minute of all this stuff.
You know, the funny thing about that was the fact that if Coach Johnson and our coaches had been on the plane, we probably wouldn't have been able to pull it off the fatigues. Back then, coaches were out recruiting, so not all the coaches flew on the plane with the team. They met you there. The guy like Coach Johnson, some other coaches were out recruiting. And that morning, when we were getting ready to go to the game or the week before the game, I said, we were like, let's do something different. So me and a couple guys went and bought some fatigues. It was supposed to be just 3 guys. Typical Miami fashion, if one guy does it, 2 guys are going to do it, then 10 guys are going to do it, and then 20 guys. And all of a sudden, everybody wants to wear fatigues. It was supposed to be harmless. It was supposed to be just, you know, getting ready to go play this game. We're all into it, a sign of solidarity. But it turned into being hated across the nation. But you know what, though? I would do it again. It was fun. You know, the sour point was losing the game. If we had won the game, there'd be more teams in the nation getting off the plane and fatigue. Everyone would be getting off the plane with fatigues on. I'll give you one incident. So the Fiesta Bowl, you know, you get sweatsuits, right? So Coach Johnson tells us, Fiesta Bowl, all the teams get sweatsuits. I talked to Joe Paterno, their team's going to wear their sweatsuits. We're going to wear our sweatsuits, okay? Now, our colors are orange and green, right? Orange, white, and green. Our sweatsuits are all black. So now we got guys with sunglasses on, some gold chains on with the sweatsuits and everything. Here's Penn State suit and tie. So we're like, look at this, man. This is messed up. So, and I'll never forget this. we're sitting at the table and Coach Paterno's talking about Penn State team. And he's like, you know what? It's nothing against Miami program. I'm sure it's a fine program, but I want you to see what type of kids play football at Penn State. I want my team to stand up. And here they are standing with suit and ties. And we're sitting here with all black sweatsuits on, sunglasses, and we're looking at each other like, I think we just got set up.
Last thing I want to ask you before we go, because you mentioned your father, and I always joke, you and I moved to Houston in the same year, 1987. We got there at the same time, and your dad was the coach at Texas Southern through a lot of this time. As a coach's son, I am curious what he thought of a lot of what was going on the field in Miami.
Oh, you know what? You wouldn't believe how disciplined our team was. Like, there were guys that got in trouble for little things like that. But the only time we saw antics out of the football team was really basically on Saturdays. You couldn't play for Coach Johnson if you didn't go to class. You know, you fighting, drugs, and all that kind of stuff. Now, he allowed you to be yourself on Saturdays. He allowed you to be excited. He allowed you to high-five and flaunt your stuff out on the field. Saturday, my dad was a disciplinarian coach, but he always told me, you have fun on the field. Work hard, have fun. That's what this game's about. You know, Miami, we weren't like a lot of schools where you had teachers and glad-handing people. Oh, you just go to class, just show. No, you had to go to class. Coach Johns used to always stress that, you know, you guys got to go to class. We'll get tutors and all that kind of stuff. But we went to class. I graduated in 3.5 years, 4 years. I don't know many players at Miami who didn't graduate. And that was what was lost in all of this. You know, we had great fundamentals, great work ethic. People were accountable, but they saw another side of Miami on Saturdays, which is okay. You know, when you're a coach's son, you can't complain about nothing. If you do what the coach says, you know why you're not good enough? Because you don't work hard enough. Like, I couldn't come home and tell my dad, hey, Dad, I'm not playing. He's going to call the school. My dad would have taken my uniform from me. And that was the attitude. And that was what made the program at Miami what it was. Hard work. You can't be successful without being accountable and working hard. It doesn't work that way.
100%. That is Alonzo Highsmith. My man, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Gabe Bassain and Tony Collette, you'd handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You'll give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.